Blog Talk Radio. Hi, welcome to the 50th episode of Elevate Your Energy Radio. My name is Evelyn Lambrecht, and I really appreciate you listening to the show. I can't believe I've done 50 episodes already. You can follow me on Facebook at facebook.com/ElevateYourEnergy, and you can download my 5 Days to More Energy at ElevateYourEnergy.com. I'm really excited for today's show. I know I say that every time, but that's because I am, and it's not just because it's the 50th, but because I've admired today's guest, Dr. Chirona Lodog, for a really long time. And I know I'm not the only one. If you listened to my last show, it was with Dr. Valencia Porter from the Chopra Center, and she considers her her mentor as well. You can listen to that show on Blog Talk Radio or iTunes. We talked about how to apply the ancient science of Ayurveda into your life. It was a really cool show, very thorough. So I actually wanted to share a little story today of what I'm doing for my birthday this summer, which will tie into the show. So in January of 2012, I attended the Scripps Natural Supplements Conference for the first time. They do it every January in San Diego. And I listened to some phenomenal speakers, but the one who really stood out to me was a physician by the name of Chirona Lodog. And I don't know if it was because she was joking about making hibiscus margaritas or kava shakes at her ranch near Santa Fe, or just her incredible background before becoming a doctor, and she'll share that story today. But she described herself as the bridge between the woman growing peppermint in her garden and the researcher isolating menthol in a lab. I just thought that was really cool. So at the end of her talk, I went up to her, I told her I wanted to come to her ranch sometime to have a margarita with her, and she said, sure. So anyway, when I say I'm going to do something, I usually tend to do it. So fast forward, actually, 2 years later to this year, and I was at the Scripps Conference again. I unfortunately missed most of her talk, but I caught the beginning of and the end, and I was once again really impressed. But so I went to her website after to see if she is still holding these retreats or whatever at her ranch, and she's now teaching a Foundations in Herbal Medicine course. So long story short, I will be spending my birthday weekend next month in Santa Fe to learn from her, and I'm really, really excited. So it's my little dorky story, but I can't wait. So let me read you her bio before I bring her on. Dr. Lodog's exploration of natural medicine and its role in modern healthcare began more than 35 years ago as she studied midwifery, herbal medicine, massage therapy, and martial arts before going on to earn her medical degree from the University of New Mexico School of Medicine. An internationally recognized expert in the fields of integrative medicine, dietary supplements, and herbal medicine, Dr. Lodog was appointed by President Bill Clinton to the White House Commission on Complementary and Alternative Medicine Policy, served as the elected chair of the U.S. Pharmacopeia Dietary Supplements and Botanical Expert Panel, was appointed to the Scientific Advisory Council for the National Center for Complementary and Alternative Medicine. She's been an invited speaker to more than 550 scientific and medical conferences, published 36 peer-reviewed articles, written 18 chapters for medical textbooks, and has authored 2 National Geographic books, Healthy at Home, which we're talking about today, and Life is Your Best Medicine. Dr. Lodog currently serves as the fellowship director for the University of Arizona Center for Integrative Medicine, where she oversees all aspects of the training of physicians and nurse practitioners in integrative medicine. Hi, Chirona. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's really my pleasure to be here with you.
So can you share your very interesting path of how you became a physician? And go ahead and share the long version, because I really like listening to your story.
Well, we all love stories, don't we? I mean, that's how people share and communicate. And I think it's one of the most important traits of healers, physicians, anybody, is to be able to listen and hear other people's stories. So mine is actually, I was very interested in massage therapy and midwifery and martial arts long before I was interested in Western medicine. And I didn't finish high school. I dropped out of high school and sort of was meandering around trying to find exactly what it is that I wanted to do with my life. I had dyslexia which was diagnosed, thankfully, early in my childhood, thanks to a very astute mother. And it helped having that early recognition and having some special help. But I tell you, by the time I got to high school, school was very difficult, reading was very difficult, and I just felt I felt overwhelmed and I think suffered probably from low self-esteem because of my difficulties in school. And so I kind of meandered around trying to figure out exactly what I wanted to do, and I ended up opening a small little leather shop. And lo and behold, one day a woman comes in and she wants me to make her a little pouch that she wants to carry things in, and she told me she was a midwife. This was in Richmond, Virginia, and I said, wow, you know, you're a midwife. My great-grandmother was a midwife, and, you know, I'd love to come with you sometime. And we started a wonderful relationship. Her name was Juba, and she taught me a lot about midwifery. She taught me a lot about herbs. She taught me a lot about women, babies, birth. She just taught me a lot about life. She was a very important person for me. And one day I got interested in martial arts from some interesting other little pieces of the story. But I got interested in martial arts, and I started taking Taekwondo down on Broad Street at Kim School of Taekwondo, 1617 West Broad Street in Richmond. And I became infatuated, and I could get enough martial arts. I couldn't get enough of it. And for me, it was this great confidence builder. I learned to discipline my body and discipline my mind. I found something I was good at, and I found that with all of the effort that I put into it, I would just get so much more back. And martial arts and midwifery and then massage school, I went to massage school in 1977, that all began to really form me. Now, herbal medicine was always a part of that. I didn't know that everybody sort of didn't know about herbal medicine. I thought kind of everybody's family had sort of taught them the basics. And so I was using herbal medicine and making remedies and things like this. And eventually moved to New Mexico, southern New Mexico, to Las Cruces. And there I opened up an herb shop and taught classes and did herbal medicine and was really enjoying my life and what I was able to accomplish with herbs. Until one day there was a migrant worker who'd come in who had a very sick child, and I suggested he take him to the clinic because I thought the baby was way too sick for me to care for and needed probably antibiotics, et cetera. And when the man came back several days later, I thought it was to tell me that the baby was better. In fact, he brought me flowers and told me that him and his wife were going back to Mexico to bury the child, which the baby had not survived. And I was, it really threw me, and it threw me in a lot of different directions. And one of the things I realized was that herbal medicine and massage therapy and so many of the things I knew were so good for so many problems, but not these really acute things that people came in with or these really, really serious illnesses. And I decided I would go on to medical school and learn all of that. And isn't it interesting that I loved everything I learned in medical school and my residency training. I loved it all because it taught me so much about diagnosis and pathology and gave me the confidence and the tools to be able to work with more serious and acute, ailments. But I also found that it was really lacking when it came to a lot of the chronic problems and many of the day-to-day issues that people deal with. It's like, look, it's like using a hammer, you know, for everything. And so many things aren't nails. So actually it was kind of maybe a good thing that I took that long, winding road, because the blend of it has worked very well for me in my own personal life and raising my children and also caring for the people that come to seek my help.
Mm-hmm. I think that's what makes you so unique, because you do have those two different perspectives and you do such a good job of blending them.
Well, and that's... You know, that's integrative medicine, and you know, I didn't know there was a name for it. There were a lot of people doing this kind of, medicine for a very long time who never had a name for what we did. Integrative medicine put a name and a framework around it, and it's why I love the fellowship in integrative medicine down at the U of A, where I'm the fellowship director. And I was delighted that you had Valencia Porter on. She is a dear friend and a precious soul and such a wonderful practitioner of Ayurveda. She's one of our graduates. And so it's been lovely, wonderful to be able to bring this to so many people.
Yeah, so today we're mainly going to talk about your book, Healthy at Home, though we will talk about life with your best medicine a little bit too, but what's the main premise of your book, Healthy at Home?
Oh my goodness, that, you know, there are so many things that you can take care of at home, ranging from menstrual cramps and headaches to upset stomachs and heartburn and diarrhea and, you know, poor sleep and everything in between. These are lots of common problems that people have that they're not really sure how to take care of. And so the book was really designed to give a lot of my recommendations, and particularly my recipes that I've used for more than 30 years in my practice, and to give people some confidence and skills for being able to take care of a lot of these problems at home. And in the book, it's very clear, I'm very clear, you know, this is when you should call the doctor, and this is when you should go to urgent care. This is when it's not appropriate, really, to take care of this anymore at home. So it's really a book that's designed to help you be able to care for you and your family safely at home, using a lot of things that you may have in your cupboard, in your garden, or which you can easily get done at the health food store or natural grocery store. And you can use them safely, effectively, and often for a fraction of the cost.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about some of those. I know digestive complaints are always very common. And actually, next week I'm interviewing Liz Lipsky on the show. But what are some things that we can do at home for common digestive issues?
Well, there's a whole lot of them. And, you know, for today, it's interesting that we have more than 120 million prescriptions for proton pump inhibitors, so things like Nexium and Prilosec, and now they're over-the-counter. So not only were they by prescription, but now you can get them just over-the-counter without any prescriptions. And I don't think most people realize that these proton pump inhibitors, they shut down acid really, really effectively, and so they can be very useful for people with more severe forms of reflux disease. But they cause your magnesium to get low. They can deplete calcium, vitamin D. They cause iron deficiency anemia. They can impair B12 absorption. They increase your risk for pneumonia. I mean, it's amazing how many warnings are actually on the label, because there are a number of concerns. You know, there's a reason you want stomach acid. It protects us and helps us, you know, be able to assimilate many nutrients. So a lot of people end up on these prescriptions or now over-the-counter proton pump inhibitors when they could do so many things at home. I'm a big fan of bitters. I love bitter herbs. And, you know, we don't get a lot of bitterness in our diet anymore because, you know, we're so addicted to sweet, to sugar. And actually, as a side note, when people start introducing more bitters into their diet, they often find that they have fewer sugar cravings. But bitters enhance digestion. They stimulate digestive juices. And contrary to what most people think, heartburn isn't so much a problem of having too much stomach acid as having poor gut motility. So things just sort of don't digest well, and you get this acid sitting in your stomach and your food sitting in your stomach and it's not moving. Bitters can be wonderful if taken before the main meal of the day. And there's a number of companies that make lovely bitter products that you know you need to taste them, so you can get those and just take them 20 minutes before your, you know, main meal of the day. You can even get something like Angostura bitters, which are available any place they sell wine and beer, and that does the same thing for people that gas, bloat, get heartburn. I tell you, bitters are one of the most amazing things you can use. Something else you may not know is that melatonin, which people think of primarily to help, you know, with people falling asleep. Melatonin, you have lots of receptors in your esophagus for melatonin, and it does two things. One is it helps to shut down stomach acid in the evening as it's time to go to sleep, and it also increases the pressure in that lower esophageal sphincter so that you don't get things coming up from your stomach back into your throat. Well, melatonin was shown in a wonderful, wonderfully done study that compared it to Prilosec and with and without. So melatonin, Prilosec with melatonin, and then just Prilosec by itself. And what they found was that the combination of melatonin and Prilosec worked very well, but at eight weeks, melatonin was as effective as a proton pump inhibitor for completely alleviating heartburn. That's pretty amazing stuff. And melatonin's available over the counter here and is quite safe. The dose used in that study was 3 milligrams. So there's a number of things people can do for heartburn and bloating and gas and easy, simple things. I give a number of other recipes in the book for like chamomile for little children with upset tummies and lemon balm and fennel seeds after a meal if you have a little bit of bloating. So lots and lots of things that can be done for digestion. And let me tell you, digestion is the foundation of good physical health. So you got to make sure the digestive tract is working in an optimal way.
Mm-hmm. With the bitters, do you just put a couple drops in water, or how do you dose that or take it?
It depends upon the bitter product. So if you're most of these bitters, it's about, you know, a teaspoon to a couple teaspoons, and those are put in a small glass of water, or I like mine in fizzy water, just taking a little bit in the carbonated liquid, and you take that before 20 minutes before the meal. Follow the directions on the bottle because, some of them are a half a teaspoon. Most of them are a couple teaspoons for bitters, and they recommend that you take them in a little bit of water. I have bitter recipes actually in the book. I gave some of my favorites that I make and use.
Great. Let's talk about colds a little bit. What are some common complaints related to cold symptoms that we don't need to run to the doctor or even to, CVS for?
Right. And, everybody gets upper respiratory infections, colds and coughs and all the things that go along with it. Children get them and old people and everybody in between. And it is amazing how much we spend on over-the-counter medications. Now, it's interesting that a number of years back, the American Academy of Pediatrics and also a number of family docs complained to the Food and Drug Administration about how many children under the age of 6 were actually being seen in the emergency room and urgent cares as side effects from over-the-counter cough and cold medications.
Wow.
And that prompted the FDA, many deaths actually, not just severe side effects, but actually children dying. So the FDA said, okay, we're going to require on these over-the-counter products that they say children under 4 should not take them. And children 4 to 6, make sure you talk to your health care provider first. Now, I remember when this happened because all the parents and radio stations, people were contacting me like, well, what do you do if you can't give your 3-year-old, an over-the-counter cough and cold remedy? What do we do? And I'm thinking, wow, really? It was just shocking to me that we don't even know, first of all, you don't have to do a whole lot for a cold. It gets better by itself. But if you want to relieve symptoms, you can do so many things. One of my favorite is thyme cough syrup. I love making thyme cough syrup. You can make it using fresh or dried. And thyme has this wonderful kind of ability to thin mucus. So if it's kind of thick, it makes it thinner and easier to cough up, while at the same time suppressing the cough. So it kind of does two things. It helps it easier to expectorate things and thin the mucus in your nose so it's not so thick and goopy, but it also quiets cough. And you mix that with honey, which honey has been shown in clinical trials to be as effective as over-the-counter cough medicine. And honey doesn't have side effects. And so you mix the thyme, you make this nice strong tea, and then you put some honey in it, and you can take that as a syrup or as a sort of a strong tea for cold and cough. If you're using it for a child that's under 1 year of age, you do want to use maple syrup, right? It's very rare, But you can have something called infant botulism if you use honey in children under the age of 12 months. So maple syrup is a preferred choice. And it also helps soothe that sore throat and cough and irritability. So, you know, think about that. No side effects, completely safe. You can get fresh thyme at any grocery store. You probably have dried thyme in your cupboard. And it works so wonderful. After the book came out, I got so many people emailing me saying, oh my gosh, this is so wonderful. It works so great. And I'm thinking, I was so happy to share the recipe. I mean, I sort of just learned it over time. You know, I've known about it forever. I've used it for more than 30 years. But I think it's not really my knowledge. This is knowledge that's been known from people for hundreds, if not thousands of years. This kind of wisdom about how to care for things like coughs and colds and bad, runny noses. Sage is another one. My grandmother, she used to take sage and she'd steep it and she'd put it by the kitchen counter. And she'd always say when we got sick with a bad sore throat, she'd say, okay, honey, when you walk through the kitchen, because you had to go through the kitchen to get anywhere, she said, just take and gargle with the sage and then spit it into the sink. She didn't tell us to swallow. She said, just spit it into the sink. And then she said, and please rinse out the sink, right? She was, you know, smart about it all. And I thought, oh, you know, that's interesting. I never thought much about it. It sure seemed to work when I was a kid. Later on, wouldn't you know, two studies done in Europe. One just used a sage spray in the back of the throat and found it was really effective for relieving sore throat pain, very effective, versus a placebo spray. And another study used sage and echinacea and found it was equivalent to lidocaine, this is lidocaine for relieving a sore throat. And I thought, wow, how did my grandma know that? I mean, how did she know sage, you know, and it has antiseptic properties too, but how did she know? And I mean, I also loved echinacea. I used echinacea a lot for myself for sore throats as an adult. And I mean, echinacea is a wonderful anesthetic. But this kind of wisdom, I don't want it to be lost. I don't want this wisdom to be lost because, you know, we're seeing more and more antibiotic resistance. We're seeing more and more over-treatments and things that don't work as well because we overuse them. So people go in for colds, coughs, and sore throats. 90% of sore throats are viral. Antibiotics are not going to do a thing for them. And we end up giving people prescriptions for antibiotics. They take them, and we see more and more resistance. This is why I think it's important for people to be able to, you know how to take care of things at home using very natural remedies. And when they should go in, let me tell you, I'm a big believer in antibiotics. I think they are kind of our modern warriors of modern times. I mean, they save countless amount of lives. The problem is they're overused, and we need to save them for the times when they're really important and not use them for minor kinds of problems for which there's no benefit.
Mm-hmm. I had two thoughts while you were talking. One is that, when I've had colds before, it doesn't matter if I try the natural stuff or if I try drugs. I feel like it kind of heals itself anyway in time. You know, depending on how much
heals itself.
Right.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But
you
don't have to suffer with a sore throat, though. If you've got a horrible sore throat, there are things you can do to relieve the symptoms of that. You don't have to take ibuprofen. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can just gargle. Gargle with just salt water if you wanted to. I mean, allergies, just using a neti pot, just using a neti med bottle, just using saline and a little baking soda can reduce your use of allergy medications by 62%. So I think that, you know, the thing to remember is the body is self-healing. It's always designed to get better. I mean, that's the old saying that the physician entertains the patient while the body heals itself. I mean, that's the old joke, is that people just kind of do things to help you while your body gets better. But it also doesn't mean that every month you have to just live through your menstrual cramps. Or if you have a headache, you just have to wait until the pain goes away. There are a lot of things that you can do for symptom relief and to make yourself feel better. And those things, hopefully, are safer then a lot of the things we end up prescribing or taking, which often have more side effects.
Right, and that's something else I was thinking. Obviously, before drugs came around, I don't know when some of those cold medicines first came onto the market, but obviously before that we were using other stuff. So.
You know, and that isn't it an interesting thing, because, you know, you raise a good, you know, you raise a point, right, that, you know, people, we've had to figure out what works. And I've always found it interesting that people today often have this notion that that there was nothing that worked before modern medicine, and that that's why we rejected everything. And I think, isn't that fascinating? What culture, what people would use something for generation after generation for hundreds of years if it didn't work? Who would do that? I mean, it might last a generation or two, but it certainly would not have lasted centuries or millennia. And I mean, that's some of the richness of traditional Chinese medicine and Ayurveda, where so much of this was written. You know, we're looking at so many of these, you know, herbal medicines in particular, and finding with modern research that they have just amazing benefits. But some of the traditions were not written down. They were oral traditions from people that, you know, many indigenous populations around the world did not have a written language. It was passed down from generation to generation through stories. And I find it difficult to believe that the people who gave us, you know, Rome, aqueducts, the Colosseum, building the Senate, you know, our very system of governance, Egypt, people who made the pyramids, that somehow they would not know how to treat many common problems that people dealt with their health. It's a very arrogant position that we hold today, that somehow all of these ancient peoples knew nothing about medicine, even though they knew everything or many things about architecture, advanced mathematics, Galileo, the universe, the sun, the solar system. Somehow they wouldn't know how to treat a sore throat? I don't think so.
That's a great point. You remind me, or what you were just saying reminded me of that book, God's Hotel by Victoria Sweet. Have you read it?
No. I love the title.
Oh my gosh. I can't remember if I've mentioned it on the show before, but I read it a couple months ago and I bought it for all the doctors I work with, and it's amazing. I think you'd love it. God's Hotel.
I'm writing it down as we speak.
Okay.
Summer reading.
Yes. You mentioned headaches briefly. I know I love using certain supplements like CoQ10. I guess it depends on the kind of headache, and sometimes peppermint essential oil, but what are some of your tricks?
I love peppermint essential oil. I think CoQ10 can be helpful. I really, as somebody who has migraines, I am pretty much habituated to magnesium, and I really, you know, it's amazing. I have thought a few times, like when we were traveling, my husband and I would be traveling, and I'd be just a couple days without magnesium. I wouldn't take enough with me, and I wouldn't think anything about it. I'm like, I'm on vacation, I'm having a great time, and then I'd start to get the aura, followed by, you know, the nausea and the vomiting and extreme sensitivity to light. And my husband is like, whenever we go away, whenever I'm traveling, he's always the one, do you have enough magnesium? Did you count out the days? because it is my best prophylaxis for migraines. And I've used it in many patients. And I mean, the thing is, you have to dose it basically almost to the point of diarrhea and then back down a little. And for some people, that may be 400 milligrams. For some, it may be 6. Some, for it may be 800. I mean, the thing to remember is that magnesium is extremely safe, and that the only real problem with magnesium is in people with very severe kidney problems, right? Magnesium, you get to that point, and for many of us, when you back it down just a little bit, you know, so we're not having the diarrhea, that's kind of the dose you need. Something your listeners may be interested in is that it's rare for an herb to reach this point, but we had a joint statement about a year, year and a half ago now, from the American Academy of Neurology and the American Headache Society, and in a joint position paper, they endorsed as a first Lyme prevention, the herb butterbur for prophylaxis of migraine, that the evidence now is strong enough that they list it equivalent to any other prophylactic drug that we use in medicine. And the thing about this is, in my experience, both in myself and many patients, they don't like taking prophylaxis things for migraines because many of them, you know, they cause constipation, they make you feel drowsy, you put on weight, you can't, your heart rate won't go up, I mean, all kinds of things. So imagine that we now have butterbur extract as a first-line endorsement from the American Academy of Neurology. Wow. So, and you need to get a butterbur extract, right? It needs to be a standardized extract because there's some compounds in butterbur that are not safe for your liver. So those have to be taken out. And don't worry, we've got great extracts in the United States, butterbur extracts. Then the dose for adults is 75 milligrams twice a day of the extract. And for children, it can be used in kids as young as 6. So the dose range is from 25 to 50 milligrams twice a day, depending upon their age. But you know, that's another one, right? So I like to use that also as a case in point for why research can be very beneficial, because it can open up other treatment options that may be useful. There was also a large Cochrane review showing that acupuncture can be extremely effective for preventing migraines as well as treating an acute episode of migraine. So for people who enjoy acupuncture, who've considered acupuncture, that might be another way to go. So, and then there's riboflavin. There's a number of others, but for me, butterbur and magnesium, those two tend to be where I start for most people, and along with things to reduce stress, because all of us who have migraines know if we don't sleep or we're really stressed out, our threshold for migraines goes down, and we're more likely to have one. So all of those kinds of things.
Was it butterbur that you talked about on the Dr. Oz show?
That was one of them, yeah.
Did butterbur sales go up after the show?
Oh, I have no idea. I have no idea.
I go on with the talk
of the research, right? I talked about chamomile, and I talked about butterbur and Sammy, and then an herbal blend for sleep. It's a really old blend, you know, of just passion flower, hops, and valerian. And that's such an old European blend, and Germany, it's like a prescription drug. I mean, you can get it prescribed as well as over-the-counter. And in a head-to-head study, it was equivalent to 10 milligrams of Ambien.
Whoa.
Isn't that just amazing? You know, and I think the thing with sleep remedies is people stop them too soon. They overestimate how effective prescription sleeping medications are, and they underestimate how well herbal medications can be if you take them in sufficient quantity and you take them for at least a couple weeks before you decide they're not going to work for you.
And what are some of your other favorite remedies or supplements or herbs for stress?
I love rhodiola. I do. I love rhodiola, especially for people who just have that, I'm so physically, mentally burned out. I'm just fried. I hurt. My body hurts. Maybe I've got fibromyalgia. I hurt both physically and maybe I'm emotionally drained. I think rhodiola is just amazing. And it's one of those herbs that I've had patients just come back and say, wow, I felt the difference. I mean, I really feel the difference. So mm-hmm. I love rhodiola. She's quite wonderful, and so, you know, I recommend that because there's so many people today that I think that fit into that category. I love ashwagandha. I love ashwagandha for people that are just wired and tired, right? It's like I'm exhausted by the time I'm 7:30 at night, and I lay down at 9:30 exhausted, and my eyes pop open, and I'm wide awake, and I can't shut my mind off. That's ashwagandha, mm-hmm. You know? I love ashwagandha for that kind of individual. I drink a lot of lemon balm because I grow it in my garden. I have a huge patch of lemon balm. I do not like dried lemon balm tea very much, but I love fresh lemon balm. And whenever I make it for people, like you're coming to the ranch this summer, we're going to drink, you know, I'm going to serve lemon balm. people just were like, oh my gosh, that is the most delicious tasting tea. And about an hour later, I'll say after a cup, I'm like, how's everybody feeling? People are like, wow, I feel so, I don't know, just mellow but happy. And I'm like, well, that could be the ranch because it's beautiful, but more likely it's lemon balm. You know, lemon balm, the old name for that was called the gladdening herb. It was to calm your heart, but to make you joyful and happy. So it has this sort of grounding but uplifting effect. And yes, studies show it relieves anxiety. Okay. But people have known it relieves anxiety for a long time. And what a great thing to grow in a pot on your porch, because it grows super easy and you can just trim it back and, you know, put a few leaves and pour some hot water over it and just drink you a cup on a day when it's just been rough, or like when you want to use it for your child. My kids, I gave them a lot of lemon balm growing up, fresh out of the garden, so they both have grown up with it. But they love it because it's super tasty. It settles the tummy, but it's also great for children. You know, the botanical name is Melissa, which means bee, like honeybee. And for me, it's lemon balm is always for, like, the little busy bees in our lives. They just kind of get overstimulated and overstressed, and lemon balm is just a great herb to relax. So those, yes, there are studies on rhodiola showing that it is good for chronic fatigue and for stress, and for anxiety and depression. Multiple studies are for depression. There are studies on ashwagandha. Its botanical name was Aenia somnifera, to induce sleep. I mean, its botanical name suggests it can help one sleep and rest. And lemon balm, as I mentioned. So for me, there's ancient stories about all of these herbs, and there is modern evidence to support their use. And for me, all of these, what am I really going to prescribe for people who are stressed out? Do I want to give them anxiety medications? Do I want to give them potent neurological medications for their aches and pains and their fibromyalgia? I would rather start with some simple and effective remedies first, and if they don't work, then I can move on. I can use something more potent. And be careful. A lot of people equate safe and simple with ineffective, and that's not true. Something can be highly safe and highly effective at the same time. So.
Mm-hmm. I have one more condition or something a little I want to ask you about. So I'm pretty allergic to mosquitoes. Like, it doesn't matter what I wear, I will get attacked in the middle of winter, you know, when there aren't even bugs around. And then I already signed up for the summer weekend with you when I got to the part in your book where you said that you have a lot of mosquitoes in New Mexico in the summer. So you're going to have
to protect me. We have hardly no mosquitoes in New Mexico.
Okay.
No.
No,
not at all. I have certainly lived in places where there are lots of mosquitoes, but it's one of the reasons we chose where we live, is because we don't have a lot of water, so we don't have a lot of mosquitoes. Also, yeah. So it's a good thing, honey. You're coming here. You know, you may have a mosquito on a night, but that's it.
Well, I will be the person who gets a bite when you don't think it's possible. So what are some, I don't know, how do you prevent mosquito bites herbally?
Well, you know, some people say you can put lots of things in your diet, nutritional yeast and other things. I mean, I have patients swear by that. We make a mosquito repellent for when we go up to visit up in Wyoming, because, boy, you talk about mosquitoes up there. Oh, good Lord. I mean, dust. There's just thousands of them. You can make all kinds of mosquito repellents yourself, and you just have to try what works for you. Whatever it is about your heat, because they're heat-seeking missiles. They look for heat, right? I mean, so that's what's attracting them is your heat. So you just have to try different things. I personally am really drawn to blends of, you know, things like lemon eucalyptus. I really like that one. Geranium, lavender essential oils. These are a number of them. I have a recipe in the book, which is a blend of those. But you can make a 1% or 2% dilution, so you can actually double the essential oils and get a 2% solution from what's in the book. But, you know, these actually, we use them because
I'm sensitive to many of the chemicals actually in insect repellent. And my skin actually breaks out. I get red, pretty significant, not burns, but pretty severe rashes from it. My daughter's sensitive as well. So we've used blends of these over the years, and I actually think the lemon eucalyptus is probably one of the key things in that essential oil blend that I use that really works. Citronella's never done a thing for me. I can light citronella candles all over our place in Wyoming, and I will still be attacked. So you just have to find what works for you, and don't stop blending. You will eventually find the right blend for you. And then all the just basic things, you know, if you don't have exposed skin, that's likely to get you. And, of course, move to places like me where it's, you know, 8 to 10% humidity and there's no water. We have no fleas at this area where we used to in Albuquerque. So up at my elevation, there's no fleas. We don't have ticks and we don't hardly have any mosquitoes. So compared to other places I've lived, like Richmond, Virginia, this is like a paradise. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So when I was first reading your book, I thought, gosh, it sounds like a lot of work, like make your own tinctures and do all this stuff. But as we were talking today, I mean, a lot of the stuff that you mentioned isn't really that overwhelming, like growing some lemon balm and making something with thyme. Where can we get some of the herbs that, like if we don't grow them ourselves, where are some good sources to get them from?
I love Mountain Rose. Mountain Rose herbs, you can just Google them online. I love them. They have certified organic. The quality of those herbs are just amazing. And they also have a lot of the supplies, so if you're making things, you can kind of one-stop shopping there. But I do recommend them because I just think they're a lovely, lovely company. Frontier Herbs is another one. Frontier is in Norway, Iowa. They have many things, including essential oils and natural flavorings and stuff like that for making things. And then, of course, your local herb shops, your local farmers markets, people that are selling some of these herbs and things like that. If you want to buy seeds, I buy my seeds from Horizon Herbs. They have organic seeds, and you know you're getting exactly the genus and species. So the folks at Horizon Herbs, they also sell heirloom kinds of seeds for your vegetables, which I grow in my garden. You'll see it this summer. We have a 68 by 75-foot vegetable garden where we grow lots of our own veggies. But a lot of those came from heirlooms from Horizon, and I get a lot of my medicinal seeds from them as well. Because if you go to, you know, the local Home Depot or Lowe's, which is good for getting your flowers to put in your pots, they'll just say lavender, and you have no idea what lavender, or they'll have marigold, and it's usually not calendula. So if you're looking for those are some places you can go. Mountain Rose, Frontier, Horizon Herbs for seeds. Those are a few places you can go to get some of these raw materials. And, you know, I guess for me, I never thought, because making a tincture is so simple, you grind the herbs and you pour the vodka over it and you let it sit for 2 weeks and you strain it out and you're done, right? And so for me, I'm like, this is simple. And I realized that I guess because I cook a lot, I just, you know, cooking is more work than making a tincture. And more work than making thyme cough syrup, you know, making spaghetti sauce or, you know, cooking up a roast chicken with potatoes and carrots, you know. So I guess for me, I think some of them may be difficult, but actually if you, like creams are harder. But making an oil, you know, making just a, you know, taking sunflower seed oil and putting some herbs in it and letting it steep for a few weeks and straining it out and having a beautiful herbal oil, that's simple. That's simple. And I would remind your listeners, sunflower seed oil is actually better for your skin than olive oil. There have been a couple of studies recently looking. Sunflower seed oil actually enhances the moisture and barrier protection of your skin versus olive oil, which actually may reduce the barrier
sort of function of the skin. So sunflower seed oil, I love it for, you know, kids, especially with eczema, where you want to stay away from almond and, you know, nut oil. But sunflower seed oil is one of your very, very, very best oils to use, especially if you've really got dry skin or eczema or anything like that. You can just use sunflower seed oil by itself on your skin, like after you get out of a bath. But if you put some calendula in it, you know, you put some herbs in it that enhance moisture and also, you know, really are nourishing for the skin, you'll have something amazing. Something amazing.
That's a great tip. Yeah, and I love that you say it is like baking or cooking your own food. It's not that hard. And you'll teach me more this summer.
I will teach you more this summer, and you're going to love it. You're going to get to go pick the herbs and play with the herbs and taste them. And, you know, I think that's what's so much fun. People come to the ranch and, you know, maybe they've never really been around chickens. And they go up and see our girls, and you can pick them up, and you see these eggs, and you're like, wow, and they see the horses.
My parents do have chickens. And I was just home last weekend. They have little chicks.
Isn't it lovely?
They're putting them inside. Yes.
Well, our chicks have not been out too long either, because just we had snow 3 weeks ago. So, you know all that from your parents. But, you know, it's amazing how many people come here and they're like, I've never picked herbs. I've never made a tincture. I've never held a chicken. I've never gone wild crafting. I've never done any of those things. I've never done intuitive tea tasting. And people come here in the middle of this beautiful, beautiful place, and I think for them it's like, this isn't that complicated, and it feels right. And that's why Healthy at Home was written, was really so people would say, I can do these things at home, these are easy, and these are the things I shouldn't be treating. Like some people wrote me and said, well, you don't have anything about cancer treatment, and I'm like, well, because this was a book about minor health problems. That's something separate. Somebody else said, but I wanted to know about, you know, how to treat my high blood pressure without using medication. And I'm like, but that's, treating high blood pressure is not something I want you to do just on your own. I want you to work with somebody, a naturopath, you know, a physician, a nurse practitioner. So the book was really designed to say, gosh, there's so many things you can take care of on your own, and they'll improve your health and make you feel better. And you can grow them, you can make them in your own house, they're cost effective, they're safe, and you'll feel a connection to the medicine that you're taking. That's important. Having a relationship with your medicine is harder to have it with a pill that comes from the pharmacy.
Mm-hmm. We only have about a minute left, so we're not going to get to talk about your other book, but I definitely encourage everyone to check out both Healthy at Home and Life is Your Best Medicine. I think you kind of have already alluded to this, but where do you hope healthcare kind of goes, you know, in the next few years?
I hope it actually becomes health promotion. How do we help people experience true health and vitality? And I hope we move away from disease management, because that's mostly what we do. We manage people's diseases. We catch things early. That's like, you know, that's early detection. But for so much of what we see, so much of the anxiety, the depression, the aches, the pains, the soul sickness that is pervasive in our society, the treatment is not effective, and it does not leave most people feeling wonderful or that they have some sense of empowerment that they can actually do something to improve it. So for me, access, universal access is a given, but universal access to the current system we have is not my dream or vision for the future. It would be far more expansive, far more inclusive, and less reliance on prescriptions and pharmaceuticals, and more exploration with an individual about what are the things that are getting in their way from getting better. How do we help them? How do we partner with them to help them experience the life and the health that they want?
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. I loved everything you shared, and thank you so much for everything that you do in the world of medicine. You are really an inspiration to so many people and so many doctors, which is awesome. So thank you.
Thank you for having me on the show, and I am so delighted that it's being so successful for you, and thank you for bringing all this good information to the people who listen. You're a blessing.
Thank you, and I will see you next month.
You betcha. You betcha. Take care.
All right. Thank you, Sharona. Have a blessed
bye.
Thank you guys so much for tuning in. I will catch you next week, and I'll be interviewing Liz Lipsky, all about digestive wellness. Have a good week.